everybody. Matt Pabala with you here on 720 WGN. Good morning, Roger Badish.
Well, good morning, Mr. Matt Pabala. How are you?
I'm good, buddy. How are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic.
Excellent. I'm very excited about the show this morning.
You have a fun-filled show.
May say that Jess Raines, our producer, has done an excellent job.
Yeah.
You know, 6 months ago, we would do a lot of taped guests.
Yeah.
I never pretended that they weren't taped. I never said live during it or anything like that. But it is difficult to find the guests you want to talk to.
Sure.
This time of night.
Yeah.
And for the last month or two, we've been live the entire time. We're making this push, not for any particular reason, other than I felt weird always playing the tapes.
Yeah.
And I would be here anyways, so it's not like I get to go home or go have a beer or anything like that.
Yeah, right.
So we're missing out on some conversations, but I think it's been more fun to talk to the listeners and to just find guests that are willing to do it. So, and we've got some good stuff here tonight. So we'll check in again with Mark Shipper, who's working on a documentary.
He is a documentary.
He's working on a documentary over in Spain. He's been filming the Running of the Bulls for the past 8 days. And I believe, was this morning? This morning will be the final run. Is that right, Jess? Is today the last day of the running, or was yesterday the last day of the running?
I believe it was yesterday.
Okay. So we'll find out from Mark, because when we talked to Mark last week, it was like day one or two.
Right.
And we said, are you going to do it? And he said, he wanted to do it. He wasn't sure after watching it if he was going to do it. So we'll find out.
I think he was leaning towards doing it, but like at the end.
Yeah.
When the Bulls are all tired.
But I think he was a little afraid that the more he watched it, the less he was going to say this is a good idea.
Right.
Because once you see a horn go through somebody's leg, you're kind of like, that doesn't seem like a smart idea. So we'll see if he did it. I'm going to bet a dollar that he did. Jess? Yeah. Or Jess, do you know?
I do not know.
You do not know. What's your bet?
I'm going to say no.
Raj?
I'll go with yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but he was probably far away from the Bulls.
Yeah, as I said last week, I don't think he will. What did he say? Call it riding the horns, where the people, he says, run so well with the Bulls that the Bulls sort of accept them into the pack.
Right.
And don't try to hurt them.
Yeah.
That seems like something that somebody made up after a lot of alcohol. No, man, I'm telling you, you just run right with them. You're right there with the horns, and you keep moving, and you don't like look at them in the eye, and they won't touch you, man. You just do it.
Yeah.
And then that buddy's dude, you know, that dude's buddy the next day in the hospital dead.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it never gets refuted, because then you say, yeah, man, try it. And then they go do it, and they're dead, and they can't tell, hey, by the way, here's what I was doing. It didn't work. So the legend goes
on. Or they're so embarrassed that they're dead. Oh, yeah, sure, no. Yeah,
so wait, so the drunk dude told you, you're right. I tripped, and they got me. That wasn't what I was doing at all.
And there was a very unpleasant horning, if you can call it
Raj,
that, during the week.
I think pretty much all the hornings are unpleasant.
No, this one was extremely
so. Unless
there
was like a one in a million shot doc type one.
This one was.
Not,
yeah.
You mean they really got him in the...
Yeah.
In the hoochie-coo?
Oof. Yep. That's the report of... I think I saw it on Wednesday.
In the tushy?
Yeah, no.
Oh, in the front end?
Yeah. There ain't going to be no more daddy.
Oh, that's interesting. Oh, did the poor guy really
That's the
lose
report
function?
I started to read, and I go, ooh, that's going to leave a mark.
Oh, man, that sucks.
Yep.
I wonder if, now this is a crazy thought, but does anybody wear a cup when they run, do you think?
You know what? I don't think a cup would help.
Well, it couldn't hurt.
No, but...
I mean, let's face it, Raj. Yeah. When the plane's crashing, they do tell us to put your head down
and kiss your,
maybe something. Who knows? Maybe something will work out. And you somehow survive this. I think it's the same theory with the cup,
right?
Or like somebody, jumping out of an airplane wearing a helmet.
Right.
As Jerry Seinfeld said, the helmet at that point is wearing them for protection. Right. So what the hell? Throw a cup on.
Yeah.
312-981-7200 is our number. So we've got that coming up later in the show, much later in the 4 o'clock hour. We will chat with Mark Shipper and find out what's going on at the Running of the Bulls. After 3 o'clock, we're going to speak with, I'm very excited about this. Did I leave the book on the other side? Here's the book. Book just came today. I sat and I read it for as long
another
as I could.
Book.
Terry McDermott, the book is called Off Speed, Baseball, Pitching, and the Art of Deception. And it's all about the other pitches. The curveball, the changeup, the slider, the spitball.
Hey, spitballs aren't allowed in baseball.
They have not been allowed for a long time.
Yeah.
Terry writes that it is believed by many that the truly good, I believe he said, forkball pitchers, they believe many of them were doctoring the ball up.
Ooh.
So it's very, very interesting sort of love letter to baseball and his longtime love of the Seattle Mariners, who have broken his heart. In fact, he wrote this book. How old is this book? This is so I heard him do an interview last week, and that's how I found out about the book. Oh, that says copyright 2017. God, it doesn't feel like it's that new. But it must have been published before the World Series last year, because he does write about being a fan of the Seattle Mariners. And the season that he wrote this book about was when Felix Hernandez threw a perfect game. I think it was in 2012. He just wrote the book recently, but he wrote it about that year.
Okay.
And I think he writes, you know, in the, I forget how many thousand games he wrote. There have been 10,000 games, 100,000 baseball games.
What, in through history?
Through Major League history.
Well, it's a 160-game season?
And
something like
so
that? And baseball's been for over 100 years.
So it's
but they weren't always 160 games.
They were 154, and there weren't as many teams. But it's got to be close to 100,000 games, right?
All right, all right.
Anyways, we'll figure that out. But I believe only 23 perfect games.
Yeah, isn't that
Think
something?
About that. That's crazy.
Yeah.
He writes, as he was talking about his Seattle Mariners, "Already damaged goods, we trudge to the exit further impaired for sure. Except for followers of the Chicago Cubs, whose fans have no excuse and less hope, this willing acceptance of pain painted over geologic layers of scars is the price paid for being a fan of a longtime losing sports team."
Yeah, it was before the World
Series.
Took
a little shot at the Cubbies there, didn't it?
Yeah. Are you going to give it to him when he...
No, no, because he grew up just outside of Dubuque, Iowa. His first ball game was like at the age of 10. His dad and a bunch of guys from the town he's from outside of Dubuque like rented a car on a train. Mm-hmm. And took the train into Chicago and went to a Yankees doubleheader at Comiskey Park. So it's a love letter to baseball and a hate letter to baseball, because baseball, you know, always crushes your hopes. And talks a lot about the crazy amount of analysis you have now for baseball and things like that. In fact, he talks about Felix Hernandez, who came into the league like at the age of 19 because he threw 98 miles an hour.
Right.
But he talks about how a pitcher cannot survive on that. Eventually they time it out. And it's all about how you – and he talks about, even though we have all of this statistics, not everybody on the team uses it. And some players are really into it, and some players are just like, eh. And the catcher for Felix, the guy who was catching that day, said, "I look at the stuff, but I got to go with what the pitcher's throwing that works for him."
Right.
And so even though if you throw the fastball all the time, they're going to hit it, Hernandez, Felix, started out – 90% fastball is always in the first inning. So batters know he's going to throw fastball. So if you can get on him, you get on him. I believe they say his ERA is much worse early in games than it is later. But he always starts out throwing fastballs. And so it's just very interesting how they analyze that and look at what they do and what they don't do. And whether or not you just say, yeah, but – and he said the pitchers often say, "I'm not going to – you know, my fastball is my best pitch. I'm not going to let that guy beat me with my third or fourth best pitch."
Mm-hmm.
It's like, yeah, but they know you're going to throw the fastball.
Right.
So you're really just taking a chance. He says it's kind of pride or ignorance that permeates, despite the fact they have so much knowledge about what they should be doing in certain situations. Anyways, that'll be a fun conversation coming up after 3. But after this commercial break, we're going to chat with – so we talked a little bit about Amelia Earhart last week. We talked more just about aviation in general. But joining us on the phone in a minute is Chris Williamson. He does a blog called Chasing Earhart. The History Channel aired their big special last weekend.
Yeah.
Did you watch it?
No, I did not, because, again, I don't have cable.
Exactly.
But I have been following the story, and I'm interested in the most recent developments about that picture.
Yeah, and I do have cable, and I still didn't watch it because I forgot. And I went and watched it on demand, and I forgot. So then I just talked to a friend who watched it.
You got the synopsis.
I got the Cliff's Notes. And so, but you're right. The big story this week has been that somebody says, "Hey, wait a minute. That picture's 2 years older than they say. It's in some book here in Japan."
Yeah.
History Channel is investigating. So Chris has been chasing Amelia Earhart since the third grade.
What?
And he's not just in sixth grade. He's like a dude like me. He's older.
Right.
So we'll see what he thinks about the photo, what he thinks about the possible debunking of the photo, and where the leads are these days for Amelia Earhart. We'll start with that right after this break, right now on 720 WGN. Matt Bubala Show, 720 WGN. The History Channel had their special Amelia Earhart, The Lost Evidence, last Sunday.
Sunday.
And then, like, 2 days later, some dude in Japan said, hey, wait a minute, that big picture that you guys have been talking about all week that proves that she was alive, that was published 2 years before she disappeared in a book here in Japan. See, here's my book. Huh. That kind of sucked for the History Channel. They're like, thank God that guy didn't say anything till after it aired, because he got 4 million viewers. I think it was the top-rated cable show of the week. Joining us on the phone right now is the man who writes the blog Chasing Earhart. His name is Chris Williamson. Hey, Chris, how are you doing this morning?
Hey, how are you, Matt? Thanks for having me on.
Good, man. Thank you very much for jumping on the show with us. Did you watch the History Channel thing?
I did, actually. I caught it around, we're actually in the middle of traveling. We're actually in Atchison, Kansas at the moment. So we were actually in Utah when that aired. And I was cutting some video together for our project that we're working on. And I caught the rerun around 12:30 at night. So I did get a chance to watch it.
And what was your overall impression?
You know, I thought it was an interesting documentary. I've spoken to Les, I've spoken to Dick Spink, and we've reached out to Sean Henry since then, actually before the documentary aired, to be part of our project and to consult and to be interviewed. And I thought it was an interesting documentary. It definitely got the world talking. And I think anytime any group, regardless of what particular hypothesis they're working at the moment, presents a new piece of evidence. And this was, of course, before, it was these new allegations against the photo kind of came out. This was kind of a bombshell photo. This was the closest thing to a smoking gun that any group had ever really produced. And I think it really got the world talking about Miss Earhart, which is always a good thing.
Yeah, I think it is. It's a fascinating topic, and Amelia comes and goes in the news all the time. I want to say that before this, the last big thing I had heard about Amelia Earhart that was in the news was talking about the bones that were discovered on an island and that were measured, that were determined to be a male, and then somebody went back and re-looked at the measurements and said, no, she was much taller, lankier than the typical woman of the day, and it could have been hers. The bones, I remember hearing, had since been lost. Only the measurements remained. Has there been any other truly breaking Earhart news in the last few years that has changed the course of the direction of the research?
Well, there's always competing work going on for multiple hypotheses being worked by multiple groups. The folks over at Tiger were actually, they just recently returned from Nikumaroro Island, which is an island that they've been investigating and working for the last 28 years. And they actually had some cadaver dogs, some bone sniffing dogs actually went out to the island. It was kind of a unique twist on their search. And I know Mr. Gillespie, who is the executive director of Tiger, is going to be preparing an actual full review of the most current data that they have. And that just actually happened, a few weeks before the History Channel really started kind of pushing their documentary for Amelia Earhart, The Lost Evidence. So she's actually been in the news quite a bit lately. This is obviously the 80th anniversary of her disappearance. So she's hotter than she's ever been right now. And she's being investigated on multiple platforms by multiple folks.
Now, I feel this way about things like this. Like when Deep Throat was revealed, it was such a cool thing because it had been such a mystery for so long. But that he was able to choose to reveal himself, right? But here, Amelia clearly can't come out and say, hey, here's what happened. Will it kill you? I mean this in all honesty. If you get to the end of your life and this is still a mystery, or is that cool because it's a mystery? I mean, like, are you like, God, this has got to be figured out?
You know, it's interesting. We're kind of approaching it from a different standpoint. I think the mystery is a big part of Amelia Earhart. And, everybody obviously as a nation, as a world, really, we love a good mystery, and history's obviously full of those. I think personally, and that's a question I ask a lot of the folks that I interview is, will they be unsatisfied if they're not able to solve this case? And I think a lot of people out there really will believe that this is something that may not never really be definitively solved. I think there's certainly a lot of people that want to solve it and that they want to get out there and they want to be the ones to kind of crack the case and say definitively, this is in fact what happened to Miss Earhart, Mr. Noonan. A lot of people, he seems to get kind of lost in all that. There was a second person aboard that plane. So there were two lives there. And I think it's one of those things that a lot of people are really trying really hard to solve. Personally for us, I think the mystery and her life, is something that's just fascinating as a whole. And the mystery, the last 20 hours of her life is the last 20 hours is 39 years of her life that a lot of people don't really discuss as much or as feverishly as they do the mystery. So for us, it's more about how she lived and not how she died.
Matt Bubala here on 720 WGN. We're speaking with Chris Williamson. He is the the founder of the blog Chasing Earhart. Is it chasingearhart.com? It is. Chasingearhart.com.
Yeah, chasingearhart.com. Mm-hmm.
All right, we've got to take a quick break for the news, but then I want to talk about why you're in Kansas right now and a little bit more about the photo and then just where you're at, because you've been writing about this, thinking about this since third grade, right?
Yes.
So this has been a hobby of yours, if we can call it that, for quite some time. So I definitely want to get your feelings on what you think happened and what you think we're going to find out in the near future. We'll do more with Chris Williamson after the news next on 720 WGN. Hey, Bubala with you, 720 WGN. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for staying up late with us. We're live in the Allstate Showcase Studio here on Michigan Avenue in the historic Tribune Tower. We're joined on the phone by Chris Williamson. He is the author of the Chasing Earhart blog and a guy who was trying to figure out the whole Amelia Earhart thing, like many people in the world, chatting about the History Channel special that aired last weekend, Amelia Earhart, The Lost Evidence. So, Chris, about this photo. So they produced this photo that seems to show what could be Fred Noonan, what could be Amelia Earhart with her back to the camera, what could be a Japanese vessel carrying the wreckage of her plane. And then a few days later, somebody says, no, wait a minute, that photo appeared in a coffee table book 2 years before she crashed. And the photo book has since been digitized. So is there, I don't know how well you followed this, Chris, but are you thinking at all, like, I'm kind of hoping, like, maybe there's a mistake, the book was digitized, does somebody really have the book, was it for sure published in 1935, do we know for sure that this photo has been debunked?
Well, we don't, and I think that's the ongoing investigation. I think history got behind it, or out in front of it, I should say. I think the day after that, the Japanese blogger found the photo and kind of put it out there on social media. And of course, that spread like wildfire, as social media tends to do. And the History Channel got out in front of it and said, we're gonna launch a secondary investigation from a secondary team that's gonna investigate the photo and see if it is in fact from a 1935 book dated 2 years before her disappearance, or if it's something that they can maybe possibly prove that is not from that particular book. So it's gonna be interesting to see what further investigation into the photo does for the photo as far as the History Channel documentary, or if it, is in fact definitively proven to be something that was shot or taken in 1935. It's definitely, kind of set the whole world on fire, so to speak, when it comes to Amelia Earhart. And it's going to be an interesting, chain of events to follow.
It seems odd that a photo that would have been published in a coffee table book in Japan would have been in our archives, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah, it does seem odd. How did it get there? It opens up a whole new list of questions. Is it just this photo? Why did this photo show up in the National Archives, as you stated? How did it actually get from Japan to the National Archives? There's a lot of questions to ask there. So even if the photo is proven to be not of Miss Earhart or Mr. Noonan, it's going to be interesting to see kind of what the origins of the photo are and how it got associated and how it got pulled in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so the last time I did an interview, Chris, about Amelia Earhart was at least a year or so ago with somebody else who's fascinated and, reads about it and writes about and researches things a little bit. And we talked about, that she had gotten very off course, that they needed to refuel, that she probably landed somewhere, and that there is an island that has been a focal point, or an atoll, a piece of an island, where it's believed she landed safely, that things have been found on this island that couldn't have been from anybody who actually lived in the area at the time. Like, I can't remember if it was a makeup case or something that would have likely belonged to an American woman at the time. Amazingly, I always was like, well, how is none of the plane found? And the belief was that where the plane landed on this atoll, it ends up getting submerged by water over and over again. And so the plane probably ended up being taken away by water. So that's the last thing I had really heard on it, or the most interesting theory that I had heard. With all the research and all the years you've spent looking into Amelia Earhart, what do you think happened?
It's interesting. People ask me this question all the time. I really don't have an answer to that question yet. I think a lot of people would kind of be in that same boat. We really don't know what happened. There are certainly a lot of different investigations from a lot of different groups that seem that, could be possible. And I've talked to a lot of folks over the last year or so that might also believe that it could be a combination of these hypotheses, that maybe she did crash but didn't sink. Maybe she crashed and then, the Japanese ship picked her up and took her back to Saipan. So it could be a possibility of a couple of different things that maybe took place and happened. It could have been, you know, a variety of factors that kind of taken that can be taken into consideration that caused her to maybe land on Nicomoro Island. It just, there's a lot of different question marks with Amelia Earhart. There's always going to be question marks. So I think from where we're coming from, and from myself and my team and our standpoint, is we're kind of creating this project based off of a non-biased platform, a non-biased point of view. So we really don't have an iron in that fire, so to speak. We're just trying to kind of collect everybody's data, collect everybody's facts, and put together the entire puzzle for the first time. And we're treating this kind of like a jury trial case. In this case, you know, everybody gets to argue their case, present their evidence, present their data. And then at the end of the day, we present it to the jury, in this case, the jury of public opinion, and say, here you go. This is the entire story. This is everybody's data. You decide what you want to believe happened. And I think it's going to be really coming down to that. I don't think it's going to be definitively proven what happened. I think it's going to take an awful lot for that to happen. And, you know, we're going on it. Obviously, this is the 80th year. So it's going to be interesting to see kind of how all of this plays out with the History Channel documentary, and then with, you know, with Tiger's findings and several other groups that are working on things. But we're just trying to document it all and present the full puzzle. So in order for us to do that, we have to stay on that non-biased platform. Otherwise, our project fails, and we definitely don't want that to happen.
Okay, so you're not going to say what you think.
I won't.
That's fine.
I really don't have an opinion, and that's the thing.
Let me ask you, Chris. I'm going to give you a call on that one. You've been doing this since the third grade. You've got to be thinking, all right, when you talk to somebody, you're like, okay, here's what I think happened. I mean, we all do that with everything. You seriously, you're like, nope, I have no judgment. I mean, it's got to be hard for you not to say, here's what I think. Here's my guess. Here's my guess what happened.
It's extremely difficult, and I get called on the carpet on that a lot. And it really is, you know, if you talk to people I've spoken to throughout the last few years, it's difficult, because I certainly think that a lot of things that are being currently worked are plausible. Some of them maybe even probable, depending on the data and the evidence. But it really comes down to you know, those folks' research and those folks' data. And you know, I'm just trying to compile it all. It's difficult. I've talked to people will make a statement, and you know, they have a really excellent point. And then there's other people I talk to that were working another hypothesis that's completely different from that one. And I can see why they're compelled to believe what they believe. You know, a lot of these folks have put 30 and 40 years of their lives into this data.
Yeah.
And you can kind of see where, okay, I get it. I understand it. And I think they're looking for a group or someone to kind of just sit and listen and not judge and not opinionate and not say, well, no, I think it's crazy, or this is, you know, a bunch of BS here or whatever. I think it's okay. Your data and your facts, your analysis is fascinating. It's interesting. I think it should be shown. And that's really the platform we have to keep. And I think it's difficult. I can tell you, like you mentioned, it's very difficult to not just say, oh, this is what I think happened.
Yeah.
But I think I really have to withhold that. I have to keep that back, because if I don't, then I'm kind of getting into the fray of my opinions and my thoughts. Now, if you ask me again in 2 years, in the fall of 2019, when we're putting our documentary out, I can maybe give you a definitive answer after everything I've learned. Okay, this is what I think happened, but really what I think is irrelevant. It really is. It's more about the data.
Since you said you're sort of putting this as a trial for the court of public opinion, when you guys finish what you're working on, will it be presented as an argument for a certain theory?
It's going to be presented as an argument for every theory. That's a really kind of interesting way that we're taking with this. I mean, a lot of people ask me, well, who are you collaborating with? And you know, and who do you support? And we say, well, we support everyone. We're collaborating with everyone. This is kind of our job. This is what we're doing. So the stars of the show are really all of our experts and all of our historians. You know, by the time we're done with this thing, we're going to have over 100 authors, experts, historians, researchers involved in this project, organizations and museums all over the world that are involved in what we're trying to do. We're trying to put forth the largest scale project on Miss Earhart and Mr. Noonan and Mr. Putnam and all the people that were around Miss Earhart's life. Ever put out. And in order to do that, we got to get a lot of folks involved. And so far we've, you know, most documentaries you watch is two or three people involved or four people involved. We have over 100 in ours.
Well, most documentaries are kind of putting together a theory of here's what we think happened. And you're not going to take that route, which sounds like very credible and journalistic and good for you guys. But it also sounds like I'm going to be really upset with you at the end of it, Chris. I'm going to go, Chris, just tell me what happened. I don't need to figure this all out. Come on, you worked on this. Tell me.
Yeah, no, I feel you, man. I really do. I think it's interesting, and you know, it definitely could sway and go a different way. I mean, if we come across something, I can tell you right now that we've been very fortunate, very very blessed to be able to speak with people that have all this great data and all this great information. They're showing us things that maybe haven't been shown before, and giving us permission to release it in our documentary and things. We're bringing interviews back from people like Netta Snook and Frank Hawks and people that have never been on film but were instrumental in Miss Earhart's life. A lot of these researchers have these interviews that are just, you know, they're old, but they've never been seen. And so we're going to combine these people and sort of bring them back and in a way and add them to everybody that's out there now. And it's been exciting to do that. But I think, you know, once this thing is done, there's a very strong possibility that we might be able to tell you, hey, this is, you know, possibly most possible likely scenario. But it really isn't for us to decide. We're just there to present it. You know, it really doesn't matter what I believe. It only matters what I can prove. And so at a certain point, you have to kind of step back and just think, take your own opinion out of it and just say, this is the data. Because so many people really just get, you know, they get sucked into this whole thing with Earhart and they latch onto a certain hypothesis and then they never let go of that hypothesis and they become blinded to everything else around it. And I think for us, we just can't afford to do that. And I think that's kind of one of the reasons that makes our project so unique.
When they talk about all the different possibilities with Amelia Earhart, is there any that you most easily, because you're saying we're going to look at all of them and that's fine. Mm-hmm. Are there ones that you say, okay, There's several popular ones out there, right? One that's very possible, she just ran out of fuel and crashed. Although we don't like to think about that one because that's very boring, right? And there's no hope for something, some good exciting ending there. Two, she landed on that island out of fuel, but they survived. But then they just ended up, you know, not surviving eventually because they were stranded on an island. Another one is that this, you know, happened sort of like the photograph. They landed, they were captured, held prisoner, whatever, eventually died. I'm sure there's a lot of other theories out there, like she came back and nobody knew and things like that. So what are the ones that you're at least looking into that you hold out? Like, here's the possibilities.
Well, the ones you mentioned actually are all possible. I think there's enough data to and enough analysis to make those particular hypotheses relevant. So the Nicomoro Island hypothesis is certainly relevant. The Saipan hypothesis, one of the oldest ones out there, is certainly relevant. Crash and sink is certainly relevant. And like I said, it could be a combination of a couple, depending on, you know, who you talk to and who you believe. So, and those individual hypotheses, you know, have individual rabbit holes that you can kind of go down. The Irene Bolam hypothesis, which is what you kind of alluded to earlier about her coming back and living life, you know, as a normal person, that has obviously been supported for many, many years since the 1960s too as well. And that's a hypothesis that kind of is largely panned by a lot of folks in the Earhart community, but we are going to give it its due just because there's a lot of people that have put so many years of their lives into it. There's folks that went to their grave believing like they knew it was her. And Irene Bolam is, you know, in and of herself is an interesting character. So we're going to kind of cover all of that. Hmm. But, you know, it's one of those things where you have to kind of investigate everything. You have to put everybody's data out there. It's like completing a 1,000-piece puzzle. If you do 999 pieces, it's not a complete puzzle. So we have to put everything out there. We have to do it, with a non-biased point of view
You know, it's funny. I just read an interesting article. It's actually about a year old from The New Yorker today, about Making a Murderer, the documentary. Did you ever watch it? And it was interesting because it was about how the documentary was made. And saying that while we have all these great shows that you know, people get exonerated and all these things happen, sometimes you have to look at these documentaries and how they're made. And the critic felt that Making a Murderer was made very biased to try to make us believe that he was innocent and framed. And while there is all sorts of great, incredible evidence of malfeasance and terrible things being done, they also present things in a way and also leave out a lot of stuff about Steven that the critic felt really like makes you forced to this point of view that, boy, he must be innocent. And so I appreciate that you keep mentioning that. Well, I'm just going to look at it like this, and we're going to present it as straightforward as possible and not lead you necessarily into a conclusion, but let you decide for yourself what you think happened.
Yeah.
In the research that you guys have done, is there anything new you found that you're like, this has changed how I look at this, or this is such a new lead that this is a theory or evidence that supports a theory that we've never seen before? Is there anything exciting and new, or is it just you have to look at everything that's already been out there and try to see, is there something we missed? Is there some new technology that helps?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. It's kind of a combination of both, I think. It's a lot of the existing data. I think the exciting stuff that we get to do is we get to hear the stories about Amelia herself and her life. We just shot actually all day yesterday with Lou Foudre and a lot of the folks over there at the Amelia Earhart Birthplace Museum, and they told us little known stories and things that, you know, that we really didn't know and I hadn't heard of, just little things. And we post stuff on our website all the time about just little Amelia Earhart stories that maybe a lot of folks might not be as familiar with as the fact that she disappeared. So it's really the exciting new stuff is in kind of speaking with all the people that we talk to that are in Amelia Earhart's life, either related by family, extended family, obviously, or, you know, researchers and case study people that are kind of working on stuff. And we get to hear kind of the inside passions. And, you know, you get to hear that data. You see that data that's out there, but you want to hear from the people and you want to hear why they believe what they believe. And, you know, you really get to hear the passion in these people's voices. And when we do our podcasts and when we do our interviews and we do our shoots for our project, our documentary, it's you really get to see the emotion and the passion in everybody's voice. And to us, I think that's, you know, that's new because we're going to present it that way. We're not going to present it as such a cold thing. It's going to, you're going to see why she has an effect on people's lives 80 years later, why she inspires children, you know, this endless parade of children, 6, 7-year-old, 8-year-old girls that dress up as Amelia Earhart, you know, and we want to talk about that. We want to tell those stories and we want to kind of talk about the people that she influences. Her reach is far and wide. And that's the most fascinating stuff. And of course, we're going to have some new and exciting things that we're going to put in our documentary. I kind of alluded to the interviews with Frank Hawks and Netta Snook. And we have a lot of folks that are in our documentary that you wouldn't normally see pop up in an Amelia Earhart project because they're relevant in some way, shape or form. So I think just offering that and offering it in the way we're doing it, I think is going to be a fresh approach and something that's been so kind of convoluted and all this watered down and all this data. We're going to try to, you know, put it all together.
Last thing I want to ask you, Chris. So when we get to 80 years down the road, I wonder if you worry that we're so far down the road that people who knew anything have died off and memories are fading and pieces are lost to history, like the bone fragments, different things like that. Mm-hmm. Or do you feel as we get 80 years down the road, the technology gets better, the research gets better, the interest maybe grows? Do you think that the further away we get, the more likely we're going to be to truly finding out what happened? Or do you worry that the further we get, the less likely we're going to be to find out ever what really happened?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, it's an answer that, you know, could go either way. The technology, as you mentioned, certainly is getting better and better as every year passes. And, you know, they're out there applying modern technology to try and, you know, especially the folks that are thinking that her plane's sitting at the bottom of the ocean somewhere. Or off a reef somewhere, they're trying to use modern technology to try to find it. You know, I think the farther it gets, you know, I think the more difficult it becomes because you like you mentioned, you do get people that, you know, the stories get lost in translation and things get lost in translation and it gets more difficult to kind of prove certain things may be true even about her life. But I think, you know, when you consider a lot of the collections that are out there, like the Sally Putnam Chapman collection that's at Purdue, and a lot of the places that, like the Birthplace Museum in Atchison, Kansas, and places like that are kind of preserving her life, and they continue to preserve things, and they continue to keep things as pure as they can. I think that as long as that goes down in history, I think everybody will have a solid foundation to you know, to study Miss Earhart's life and her legacy and her impact and her resonance. You know, and I think it's only going to grow. So I think it's going to be more difficult as time goes on, but as long as stuff is preserved correctly, I think, you know, we'll continue the search, and I think people will always be fascinated with her. And we're just hoping to tell people a little bit more about Amelia Earhart, the person, and her, and talk about her life, and people will be more fascinated with her life and not necessarily the last 20 hours of her life.
Right.
And I think that's a really key thing.
I feel like, and I feel bad, but I feel like you kind of look down on somebody like me and say, you just care about the last 20 hours, and she was more than that. And I realize she was, but this is the really, really fascinating part.
No, I get you. So then,
Chris, tell me, because we've done this on the show before. I firmly believe, and it is my greatest hope, that before I die and leave this earth, we will have discovered that life does exist elsewhere in the universe. Intelligent life exists mm-hmm. elsewhere in the universe. So I figure I got hopefully 50 years left, and we're going to figure that out by then. So let's assume you have 50 years left, Chris. Will we know definitively by the end of your lifetime what happened to Amelia Earhart?
I'm going to hope and say yes, that we'll know.
Good.
I'm going to hope and say yes, that we'll know. That's just the optimism in me, and I'm hoping that you know, we can contribute in some small way to that. And I'm really hoping so, because I think a lot of people really want to know. I think the general public wants to know, so they can kind of put that to rest and And I think she deserves it. I think she deserves that kind of finality, that definitive finality that people have been searching so desperately for 80 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, for the sake of her family and her extended family and the Putnam family. And I think it would be nice to just kind of say, yes, now she can rest finally in peace. And this is what happened.
It would be cool to find out. Chris Williamson is the founder of the Chasing Earhart blog, chasingearhart.com. He follows her and has lots of great information there. And when do we expect to see the project that you guys are working on come to fruition?
Well, we're actually, if you keep up with the website, we're going to be releasing our documentary in the fall of 2019. We're going to be shooting stateside for the next year, and then we're going to go international the year after that. And then we're finally going to release the project. Our podcast release is biweekly, so we have another episode dropping next Thursday to our subscribers. If you go to our website and subscribe, it doesn't cost anything. You'll get it a day early. If not, it goes wide Friday. And we have a couple of exciting projects we're working on right now. We're going to be working with Astonishing Legends and that team over there, doing a joint podcast release in the next month or so. That's going to be really exciting. We're really honored to have them aboard the project. And you can just follow us all on our website. And you can, of course, follow us on Twitter. It's just at Chasing Earhart, and then facebook.com/ChasingEarhart. And, of course, the website, chasingearhart.com.
Chasingearhart.com to find out the latest information. Chris, we'll talk again. We appreciate you jumping on the phone.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
You bet, man. Have a great night, and we'll find out. We'll see what the History Channel says as they continue their search on what happened with the photo. If some guy there's like, dude, I thought you checked that. I swear I did. I didn't realize it was in another book. My bad. Some intern there going, my bad. Sorry about that. 312-981-7200. We're going to talk about the fastball and why it's not the best pitch. It's not the most deceptive pitch. A great book about pitching and the art of it after the news, which is next on 720 WGN. Matt Bubala with you, 720 WGN. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for staying up late with us tonight and every weekday night. Well, with me just on Saturday mornings, quite honestly. But thank you for anybody who listens at any time here to the great WGN radio. Joining us on the phone right now is a man who maybe caught the waves of WGN and some Cub games in his youth just outside of Dubuque, Iowa. Terry McDermott is the author of Off Speed, Baseball, Pitching, and the Art of Deception. He joins us on the phone right now. Hey, Terry, how are you this morning?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm good.
It's not morning here. It's not morning. It's late. It's late at night here.
It's morning wherever you are, Terry. Come on. It's late. I appreciate you staying up and hanging out with us. And I've really enjoyed your book. It just came in the mail today, so I've gotten close to halfway through it. But I just love the way that you sort of I've been describing it to friends as a love and hate letter to baseball all at the same time. Because baseball is go ahead.
Much more love than hate.
Yes, of course. But, you know, as a fan of the Mariners and as you know us fans here of the Cubs, baseball can be a very frustrating experience, even if you don't play the game but and are just a fan of it.
Yeah, you know, being a sports fan is kind of a weird thing, isn't it, in a way? And being a fan of a generally kind of a crappy team is, there's no rational explanation why anybody would do that to themselves. You kind of just end up there somehow, you know, it's like you're a piece of driftwood and that's where you came ashore.
I think eventually when you get beaten down so bad, it becomes a bit of a badge of honor, doesn't it? That you start to wear proudly like, that's right, I am a Cleveland Browns fan and someday we're going to do it all. And I will be there because I'm not going to walk away from this.
No.
Well, I can say that. I can say it, Terry, because you know what happened here in Chicago last year. So, my 44 years of ineptitude paid off.
Yeah, well, there's no honor in it, as far as I can tell. winning must be fun. I don't know. I've heard tell that it's a lot of fun.
Well, and I think it's. I understand you're saying there's no honor in it because you haven't gotten there yet. But when you do, you think it was all worth it. It's like living in Chicago, I always say. We suffer through the winter. It sucks. It's awful. And we all say, what the hell are we doing here? But then when spring hits, you think, this is why. because all that suffering made this moment that much more sweeter. When the weather comes back and everybody's wearing less clothes and they're eating at, you know, out on Michigan Avenue, it's just, it becomes this awesome time of year. But it wouldn't be as nice if it was San Diego year-round, right?
Well, no. I mean, then look, if you're in Chicago and you're waiting for spring and then spring is over, then you got summer. And summer's even worse than the winter.
Oh, not even close. No. Maybe like in 95 when 400 people died. But otherwise, no. It's not that bad in the summer. It's still pretty nice.
You know, I moved to Southern California 20 years ago from the Northwest. I lived in Seattle and Portland for a long time. And Southern California was the enemy. I mean, like, you know, up there we were cool. We were hip. And
right.
We were progressive, and this was the land of God knows what went on down here. And I came here for a job, not because I ever wanted to be here, because it really was like going into enemy lands. And I got here, and it's like you walk out every day and you go, who knew?
How nice it could be, really, the weather. Yeah.
Yeah, we've really been hiding this stuff. It never fails to satisfy. It's, other than the fact that you can't drive, you can't leave your house, you know.
Little things.
Yeah, little things. Can't breathe.
I moved to L.A. out of college, so I lived there for 2 years, and I will say that I know that now I'd probably appreciate a lot more, but at the time, I missed, like, thunderstorms and real weather and you know,
that's
in the
true.
Summer when it was 100 degrees 84 days straight, it kind of, like, got depressing, I thought, too.
Well, I live 100 yards from the beach, so it never gets to be 100 degrees here. I mean, a hot day here is 82. You know, a cold day is 62. So it's pretty nice. But I know what you mean about real weather. I mean, I can remember, I remember driving, you mentioned Dubuque, from Dubuque to my hometown of Cascade one night, in must have been 1969 or 70, and ran into a thunderstorm that was so bright. I turned my lights off and drove for 20 miles. It was thunder and lightning the whole way. I mean, scare the hell out of you. Man, that's real weather.
That is real weather. So you grew up in Cascade, Iowa. How far outside of Dubuque is that?
25 miles.
25 miles outside of Dubuque. So you probably, as a kid, you mentioned that you built your own little radio and you'd have to hang it on the highest pole in town to get the to get a signal. Yeah. Did you pick up some Cub games on WGN as a kid?
Absolutely. WGN and KMOX were the big stations that I could get.
Wow.
I mean, I could get local stations, but the only two places out of town I could get were those two. They were both big powerhouse stations, still are, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
You get those. And if you're a kid, look, Cascade was 1,000 people. And, you know, you knew everybody in town. They all knew you, which was, like, good and bad. But, you know, getting the radio signal from Chicago was like, my God, there's life on Earth.
Now, how in the world do you become a Mariners fan? Because you grew up a Yankees fan because your dad's a Yankees fan. But you're in Iowa. You're picking up Cub games and Cardinal games. How was your life and your allegiances not set in stone by the time you got up to the Pacific Northwest?
Well, you know, I sort of fled Cascade. It's a weird thing. You know, when I think about it now, and whenever I've talked about it to people ever since leaving, it seems like an idyllic thing, right? It was like a Huck Finn childhood. It was magical in a lot of ways. It was completely innocent. It was wonderful. I left the first train out of town, man. And I've been trying to figure out why ever since. But I went to the, like, completely the wrong place. I joined the military, which I wasn't suited for whatsoever. And kind of lost track of baseball and family and community and sort of myself for a while. And ended up in Portland, Oregon in the middle 1980s. And discovered Bill James, of all things. I joined a fantasy baseball league, one of the first fantasy leagues in the world, and discovered Bill James through that. Just wasn't even a fan, really, but just wanted to win the fantasy league. and then fell in love with the statistics of the game. And then a couple of years later, moved to Seattle and started listening to this great play-by-play guy that the Mariners had then, Dave Niehaus. I mean, wherever I was, even when I wasn't really a fan anymore, I listened to baseball on the radio. Baseball on the radio is the best thing ever, right? I mean, it's better than sex. You don't turn radio dials anymore. But when you did, without ever hearing anybody talk or anything else, when you hit a baseball game, you heard it, right? It's just it's like that hum, this weird thing out there in the universe somewhere. You just hear that noise, that background. Man, just a great thing. And a great play-by-play guy is like a seductress. I mean, they make you fall in love.
Well, I'm going to send this tape to Pat Hughes. He's really going to love everything that you just said. I think he's going to love it. He's going to be a little freaked out by it, but he's going to love it.
No, man, it's the best thing about baseball to me is listening to it on the radio. I mean, I love going to games. I've been to literally hundreds of them, maybe thousands. Jesus,
yeah,
that's
crazy.
Yeah,
I would think by now.
I came back into it, and I was actually a fan of Niehaus before I was a fan of the Mariners, because then, as now, they were a pretty bad team. They had high points in there, but
sure.
But they weren't real good then. And I realized, it really reattached me to my love of the game from being a kid, and learning the game from my dad. And I had kids of my own. Three daughters, and they all learned to play, and they became fans. One of them is a White Sox fan, by the way. Mm. She lived in Chicago for 5 or 6 years and became a White Sox fan. So, it's just a good life companion. I mean, baseball is there.
It really is.
I tell people all the time, it's like, look, people complain about it's too slow, it's too this or too that. I says, look, you take whatever you want. Baseball will allow you to take how much of it you want or how little. You go to a game, you don't have to watch every pitch. I do. You don't have to. I mean, you can have a conversation with somebody. Mm-hmm. You can have a beer. You can take a nap. I don't care. But you come back, baseball is going to be there for you. It gives what you want.
I agree completely. The MLB Network ends up on our TV every night at night. It's background. You can walk in and out of a ball game. You can't really do that with most other sports that are on TV. It kind of commands your attention or it doesn't. But baseball, you can keep coming back and forth, figure out what happened, and talk. I mean, let's face it, it's the only sport really without a clock. So although they keep trying to put one in the game, basically. But but it is a relaxed pastime. I mean, it really is America's pastime. And it does seem to bring family together and give people a bond that I don't think anything else quite does in the same way.
I used to joke with people that intellectuals love baseball because it's the only game that's slow enough they can understand. and I think that's true to a certain extent. It's there, right? You can see it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. That's true. You can see it. The book is called Off Speed, Baseball Pitching and the Art of Deception. We're speaking with Terry McDermott. Why did you decide to write about pitching in particular if you're going to write a somewhat love letter to baseball?
Oh, man. I'd written three other books. I've been a journalist for a long time and left newspapers and started writing books. And two of the books were on 9/11 or aspects of terrorism. And one was on brain science. These were not easy undertakings.
I would imagine not. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I'm a journalist. I don't know anything about anything. I just I have a notebook and a pen and a willingness to learn.
Yeah.
The terrorism books in particular just wore me down. I mean, I was depressed, exhausted. Mm. It's a very enveloping subject. Obviously it has some import in the world, but it's a hard thing to report about, and it's not a good thing to think about. I mean, I dreamed about it every night for years, 5-6 years. And at the end of the second terrorism book, I had had it. I was just dead to the world. And my agent said, why don't you do something fun? Well, he and I, he's a New Yorker and was a Mets fan. And whenever we would get together, we would talk about baseball, not terrorism or, mm-hmm. or neuroscience or anything like that. He says, write a baseball book. And I said, you know, I'm a serious guy. You know, there's a lot of baseball books out there. There's a lot of baseball writers that I, you know more about it than I do. I said, I don't, yeah, that's just, I should do something important. He says, man, you're stupider than I ever thought you were. Take a break. You know, write the book, have some fun. He says, what do you want to do? I says, I don't know. I mean, you know, how about Alzheimer's? That'd be a good book. He says, oh, yeah. Yeah, let's have some fun now, guys. He it didn't take much to persuade me that baseball would be a good thing. And you know, the heart of baseball is the pitcher-hitter confrontation. That's the whole game.
Yeah.
And that's where it gets interesting and fun. That's where it gets tricky. If you're going to write about it, it's probably a one-time thing for me. I'll probably never write about another book about baseball. My next book's probably going to be on the Kardashians. So,
you're going back to serious journalism, I see. Okay.
Well, no, it's trying to explain Trump. I think there's a relationship there.
Well, that's interesting.
That deserves to be looked at. If you're going to write one baseball book, you got to write about pitching, right?
Yeah, it makes sense. And I've never seen a book written, or I've never heard of a book, if it has been, to try to explain the different pitches and why they're so important. Because really, you know, you write about it in the book, and all we really talk about, you know, on the MLB Network. So we watch Quick Pitch and the highlight shows every day.
Yeah.
And what do they show all day long? They show home runs, or if a dominant pitcher throws a bunch of strikeouts. And generally, it's you want to see the clock, and is he hitting 100 miles an hour? Or Aldis Chapman's hitting 105 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And it blows you away. But as you write in the book, and as people have said forever, if all you have is that fastball, it's not going to get you as far as you think. Even if you're throwing it 105 miles an hour, eventually these guys are going to time it, and they're going to kill it, right?
Yeah. There's two things, my two favorite things in this book. One of which I didn't even report. It just was James Shields, the right-hander, who's on a bunch of teams. He's been a good major league pitcher. He wrote a really nice memoir, 5 or 6 years ago. I mean, Christ, how long has he been in the league? I mean, he wrote the memoir probably earlier than anybody ever.
Hmm.
But there's a line in it. He says, like, if a major league hitter gets what he's looking for, he'll take you to the moon. You know, and it's so true, right? If you're not deceiving them, you're going to be dead eventually. And the other thing is, the guy I originally wanted to feature in the book, which it didn't work out, was one of my favorite all-time pitchers, Jamie Moyer,
mm-hmm.
who was, you know, the best Mariner pitcher, the winningest Mariner pitcher ever, but a guy who pitched until he was almost 50 years old, you know, if you watched him pitch, it was like you or I playing catch. I mean, he couldn't hardly break a window pane with his fastball. I mean, he won 20 games late in his career with the Mariners. I don't think he was topping out at like 83, 84. And he would throw back-to-back-to-back changeups.
Mm.
And I asked him once, I mean, aren't you like physically afraid of getting hurt? You know, throwing this like 78-mile-an-hour dinky little thing up there to these goons at the plate. He just laughed. He thought that was the funniest thing ever. He says, look, if it wasn't for the vanity of major league hitters, he said, I would never have had a career at all. And that's completely it. He says, they're always sitting there looking fastball. It doesn't matter if you've thrown them 8 changeups in a row. They're looking fastball. They just do not want to get beat. It's because, you know, they're manly, right?
Yeah.
They don't want to get beat.
They're up there to hit that ball hard.
Right, yeah. That to me was the whole inspiration for the book was that, you know, how can a guy just get by on nothing?
Well, and it's fascinating, Terry, because, and I have to take a quick break and do the news real quick. Can you hang on and do some more with us?
Yes.
But I want to get into, because you mentioned that he says if it wasn't for the vanity of these hitters, but if it wasn't for the vanity of the pitchers, because you talk about the fact that these pitchers and their catchers are oftentimes, you know, they have every statistic in the world available to them now about what this guy will swing at, what this guy will miss, what are the percentages are of everything he's done. And the catcher will go, yeah, but his good stuff is his fastball. Or the pitcher's like, I'm not letting him beat me with my third best pitch. I'm throwing him the fastball.
Instead
of, you know, thinking about these things a little more, maybe, you know, with some of the knowledge that's provided to them about what's most likely to work here. We'll get into more of that. We're speaking with Terry McDermott, the author of Off Speed, Baseball, Pitching, and the Art of Deception, after we check the news next on 720 WGN. Matt Bubala here with you on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Showcase studio on the Magnificent Mile. Terry McDermott, the author of Off Speed, Baseball, Pitching, and the Art of Deception, is still on the phone with us. Did you hear that little commercial I did on the way in the news? The Sox and the Mariners are playing tonight.
Yes, they are. And, in fact, the guy we're just talking about, James Shields, gave up the big dinger last night.
Oh,
so way to go, James.
Poor James. Is Felix Hernandez still pitching for the Mariners?
Well, what kind of a question is that, man?
He's
still pitching. Yeah.
He's on the Mariners. What do I care? I'm a Cubs fan. I don't know. They never play the Mariners. I don't follow the American League. I don't follow the junior circuit.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's look. Let's check our records here the last century, see how the senior circuit is doing.
Here's what I know.
Yeah,
the Chicago Cubs won the World Series last year, and I will say that forever, and that's all I care about. Believe me, all my White Sox fans here in town still like to talk about how they won the World Series. I'm like, that was like a decade ago, remember? That's crazy. A decade ago. God, they hate that now. Is he still pitching? He is.
Yes, he is. Yes, he was hurt a little bit this year. He missed some time, but he's back. He's the king. The king is back on the hill.
I was looking at Baseball Reference earlier today. All right, so 2000. So is he 4-3 so far? Is this updated? I think he's 4-3 so far this year. He hasn't had a really good year. I mean, he's had two really good years since the Cy Young year, though, right? In 2009, he went 19-5. Since then, 2014, he went 15-6. 2015, he went 18-9. So that's two really good years, but. His overall career record's 158 and 112, which isn't bad, but it's not incredible. Is that mostly because of the teams he plays on?
Yes, the teams sucked. mostly, yeah. No, entirely. He's the king. Come on. Yeah, look, he's changed, as everybody does. He came into the league at 19 and was just a pure, he threw heat. And he's developed a bunch of different pitches. He's one of those guys. There's a couple guys every generation, I think, who can pretty much throw whatever they want. I think Greinke's that kind of guy now. David Cone was like that. You know, he can just almost make up pitches on the spot. And Felix is like that quite a bit. He's got enormous gifts as an athlete. His problem, and I guess every pitcher's problem, is he can make the ball do lots of things, but can he make it go where he wants it to go?
Yeah.
I mean, his pitches honestly break too much. So his biggest problem is putting them in the right place all the time. He's still there. He'll be there in the series this fall. You wait.
I'm sorry.
I can't believe I just said that.
Yeah, well, because you've clearly been drinking because it's the middle of the night.
He's there. He's still the ace. Well, actually, they have a really great young left-hander, James Paxton, who's really emerged as the ace of the staff now. But Felix is a good, solid, well above average big league pitcher, and will be for another several years, I think.
You write in the book that even if the hitter expects a fastball and gets one, the harder it is thrown, the less time he has to catch up to it. The faster it is thrown, the quicker it arrives. Guys who throw the hardest have the biggest advantage. The difference in time available to a hitter between a 90-mile-per-hour fastball and one thrown at 100 miles per hour is approximately 40 milliseconds. Doesn't sound like much, but it represents a 10% cut in the time allowed to the hitter, time a hitter can't afford to lose. So when Aroldis Chapman throws it that hard, and it's hard for guys to catch up to it, but he, although he loves throwing the fastball, also likes throwing, I believe, a slider. And the last, I believe he was the most recent, unless Glavin beat him afterwards, the most recent 300-game winner, was it Greg Maddux? Maybe one other person has done it since. But Greg Maddux, like you were talking about another pitcher earlier, I mean, what he topped out at generally most of his career, about 86 miles an hour for his fastball, right? So deception does play a huge part of true success. While the fastball and the harder you can throw it is great, especially for an inning at a time for Aroldis Chapman, for most guys, if they come out and try to throw six innings of fastball, especially when you're going to face a batter a second time, and that maybe that explains a little bit why, because you write about Felix Hernandez, and especially you kind of go over his perfect game throughout the book as you talk about the different pitches. But Felix, despite the fact that everybody knows he likes throwing fastballs early, and despite the fact that that isn't what always gets guys out, he tends to start his games, or at least he used to, throwing a ton of fastballs early on. Is part of that because the first time guys see somebody, it's harder to time it out, and then you got to work more stuff into it later in the game?
I think it's because humans are stupid. If I were a pitching coach, thank God for Major League pitchers that I'm not a pitching coach in the majors. I don't understand why pitchers don't throw more off-speed stuff early in counts. The truism of baseball is the best pitch of baseball is a located fastball. If you can throw a fastball where you want, you're going to succeed. Mm-hmm. I mean, even if you don't really have much of anything else. Just because you talked about how much time a hitter has. It takes 400ths of a second for the ball to go from the pitcher's hand to cross home plate. And the batter has to start to swing, decide where and if to swing halfway through that, 200ths of a second. That's how long it takes you to blink your eye. I mean, there is no time. So if you can throw hard, you're robbing time from the hitter. That's all a pitcher's doing is robbing time. So if you can throw hard, for goodness sakes. But if you can't locate perfectly, and you talk Maddux, man, that guy was just a thief. Because he couldn't throw hard. And he would go a whole game without throwing a breaking ball. All he had was that little cutter. I mean, Mariano made the cutter famous because he was so great at it because he was in New York. But Maddux threw cutter after cutter after cutter, and he just threw it into a teacup and didn't have the break of Rivera's at all. It had this little 3 or 4 inch thing. But, man, he just threw it where he wanted. And it's just he was he just cut you up, a surgeon, and take out your heart and you stand there still watching him wondering what happened. Guys, you can throw the ball where they want to throw it. I think maybe you can throw it any speed you want, and if you can do that, you'd win.
But they can't all do that, so they develop the other pitches, right? And you write about it. You have a lot of great history of the game stuff that I didn't know, whether it comes to how the baseball's made and built and what goes into it, how many they use a game, different things like that. But especially the really early history of baseball, when it resembled cricket a little more than anything else, where the pitchers got a running start and then threw it underhanded, and the batters could actually even request where they wanted it. Now, what I didn't see you write about, maybe I missed it, is how willing were the pitchers to then throw it where the batter wanted? Did they say, sure, Mac, and then not throw it there? Or did they really not care at all? So, sure, fine, we'll serve it up to you. That's my job.
Well, I think pitchers started cheating the first time there were pitchers. I think that they started. Nobody wants to do that, right? Nobody wants to.
I wouldn't think so.
Get the crap beat out of them. They started cheating almost immediately. It was a hitter's game, but it didn't take many years, a couple, 10 or 15 years, 20 years, I guess, before they started letting them throw overhand. And as soon as that happened, then all hell broke loose. I mean, then they started doing everything they could possibly imagine. I mean, they were, we think about like the spitter being a terrible illegal pitch, they would, like, there was a guy who put the whole ball in his mouth and made it wet. A guy could take the ball and grind it into the dirt with their foot, with their spikes. You play the whole game with 3 or 4 balls.
And the balls weren't even good to begin with, right? I mean, they weren't put together like they were now.
Yeah, I mean, they were soft. I mean, they were certainly soft after a few innings. It was just horrible. I don't know how anybody ever hit them. You know, that's the whole dead ball era came because of that, because of the abuse these guys gave to the balls. I mean, now it's hard to imagine when a ball gets taken out of play every time it touches the dirt.
Yeah.
You know, then it's just, no, I'm sorry, this ball's here until it's gone. So it literally falls apart sometimes. Yeah, it's a whole different baseball then. It's hard to imagine what it must have been like. nothing like what we see today,
yeah,
for sure.
Kidding. So what is the best pitch, most successful pitch, outside of a well-located fastball?
Man, it's different in every era. You know, there, it depends on who the guy is. I mean, you know, Rivera's cutter, Carlton's slider, Koufax's curveball. But Willie Stargell said, you know, trying to hit Sandy Koufax's curveball is like trying to drink coffee with a fork. it just wasn't possible. You know, so there's a guy, there are guys every era who just have pitches, single pitches that are impossible to hit. So I don't think there's ever been any one pitch that's unbeatable. I mean, as a Mariner fan, I mean, Randy Johnson's slider was right up there with Carlton's. I mean, Steve Carlton, the great St. Louis and Philly pitcher of the 70s, you know, he was asked one time by Roy Firestone, he says, why were you put on this earth? And Carlton said, to teach the world how to throw the slider. You know, pitchers are weird dudes. You know, they're not, you know, players don't regard pitchers as players. I mean, it's really odd, because a lot of times the pitchers are the best athletes on the team.
Yeah.
Because they were the guy who was in high school. They were, you know, they lettered in everything.
Well, and pretty much funny, Buddy and I were just talking about this the other day, that every pitcher in baseball, it's funny to see when they bat and they really can't do much, so many of them, because, you know, in high school they were probably the best hitter. I mean, all these guys were probably by far the best player anywhere near anywhere back when they were in high school, and they probably all could kill the ball like crazy when they were hitting.
Yeah, right. That shows you how great professional athletes are, right?
Yeah.
At the thing that they do. Because you're right. I mean, every pitcher in the majors, or most of them, were the best hitter on their team when they were a kid. And now they can't hit anything.
Yeah.
It tells you how good the real hitters are. But for the pitchers, if you think about it, I mean, I used to think that, you know, the best job in the world would be to be a punter on an NFL team.
Sure.
Right? Because, like, what do you have to do, right? I mean, if you can punt, you can win four or five times a game. You know, and if the snap is wild, it ain't your fault. You know, you almost have no chance to screw up. You just go out there a few times. They can't run into you. You just kick it, and it goes down the field. Then you trot off. You probably don't have to wash your uniform twice a year. but pitchers are pretty much like that. I mean, if you watch pitchers like before games, if you go out to the park really early and watch them, I mean, they're just hanging out. You know, they trot around. They might run a couple sprints. You know, they'll shag some balls. But they're just goofing.
I have always thought that to be a starting pitcher and have those 4 days where you're just hanging out at the park, eating some Cracker Jack, talking to the guys all day long, that would be pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. And they have a lot of time on their hands, so they're always coming up with new pitches.
Yeah.
That's where the pitchers come from, is all that downtime. They're just hanging out. It's got to be the coolest thing in the world. And plus, you know, they get paid quite a bit.
Yeah.
I heard.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. And what do you make of, we touched on this a little bit earlier, but what do you make of all the statistics that are available today, the just amazing amount of information you could have about any batter, any hitter, yet a lot of these players tend to ignore it and go on gut instincts or what seems to be working and what seems to not be working?
Yeah, you know, there really is a lot of see the ball, hit the ball in the big leagues. A lot of people don't want to be confused. You know, they know what they can do. And especially with pitchers, the general feeling is that you know, look, I don't care what this guy hits or doesn't hit. I know what I can do. And why should I let him dictate to me what's going to go on in the at-bat? It's foolhardy, I think. And I think over time that will change. I think people will be pitchers will be forced to take into account the data that's available to them. But right now, I think we're at sort of this early period in this where pitchers don't pay that much attention, don't want to. They don't want to cloud their minds. You know, professional athletes, baseball more than probably any other sport, there's so much randomness in it. You know, a hit a week is the difference between a guy who's 250 and a guy who's an all-star.
Yeah.
You know, and a hit a week is what? A ground ball in the hole. It can be anything. So it's like you try to do the same thing over and over again, over and over and over and over again, and yet the results are so disparate. They're just scattered all over the place. And you're going like, man, I did exactly the same thing as the last time. The guy took it into the third deck. It's just this bizarre outcomes from guys who try to be as mechanical, as ruthlessly efficient as they can, and things happen. So they don't want to clutter their minds with other stuff. I mean, they just want to do the thing that they know how to do, the thing that they've been doing their whole life. I must drive, I know that for a fact that it drives coaches and teams crazy. And we've had a lot of, we're still in a period where there's a lot of friction, I think, between the people with the data and the players. There are a lot of players who adapt it fully and love it, but they're regarded, even the player, a player who's a data freak is regarded weirdly by, it's his teammates think he's an odd guy. Because they all know, everybody's self-image is set when they're 15 or something like that. And as we were talking before, these guys were all studs when they were 15.
Yeah.
You know, so why should they have to, like, think? You know, they don't think for a living. They play baseball. And they have this one great skill. Love to do it.
Well, so when I watch Cubs games, I feel like Wilson Contreras, who catches for the Cubs mostly now, is always looking at the dugout between pitches. And I always assume that for a lot of these catchers, the manager or pitching coach or whoever is telling them what pitch to call. So I'm surprised that all these pitchers are getting away with just doing whatever I think this feels best, and that the managers aren't saying, okay, we have all the statistics that show we can't throw 90% fastballs in the first inning, but here you are. So we're going to take this over and tell you what to throw. Why is that not taking more hold?
Well, it has. I mean, I think it's slowly ebbing away. I think it's going the other direction. I think that there's only a few guys in the managers and the majors that would call pitches. I wasn't aware that Madden does it all the time. I'm not a big Joe Madden fan, so I'm not surprised.
What? Oh, geez. Here we go. Man, you got a bitter thing going there, Ter. Bitter.
But Mike Socia calls all the pitches, too. I live in Southern California.
You also don't like Mike Socia, though. I read you wrote something like, and then God put Mike Socia in the Angels dugout.
But he calls all their pitches. You know, I was like, yeah, come on, guys. Let the pitchers pitch.
Oh, that is so funny. You write all this about how they have all this information, but they're either too proud or stupid to use it. Now you're the one to be like, ah, just let the pitchers pitch. They know what they're doing.
I didn't say they knew what they were doing. That's not what I said.
That's true. You didn't. But you seem to intimate that if you're saying let them have control.
No, I'd be happy to have let them do that and let my guys just wail away. Look, Solskjaer and Madden have both been very successful in their benighted lives.
Yes, so, they have.
Maybe they know what they're doing.
They have done well. So the book follows Felix Hernandez's perfect game and goes through the pitches, the fastball, the sinker, the knuckleball, the curveball, with little interesting bits of information on a lot of times how the pitch first started, who first used it, if that can be figured out, how it works, what it's supposed to do, and how it's been abused by pitchers since the game began. The book is called Off Speed, Baseball Pitching and the Art of Deception by Terry McDermott. Terry, thank you so much for jumping on the phone with us. This was a pleasure.
Yeah, it was fun for me too. Thanks for having read the book. It's nice.
Yeah, absolutely. It's good. I'm gonna keep reading it. I'm gonna pass it along to my 16-year-old son. He's a pitcher, and he won't throw the ball any harder because he's afraid he's gonna lose location. So. So he's the opposite of most pitchers out there right now, unfortunately. A little too much so. Thanks again so much, Terry. Thank you. We'll talk again soon, I hope so. Terry McDermott, Off-Speed, Baseball, Pitching, and the Art of Deception. Can get it online, or if you can find an actual bookstore, you can find it there, by golly. 312-981-7200. We'll take a break. Why, thank you. Okay, at 4:30, we're going to check in with the running of the Bulls. We've got some other interesting news to talk about after we check the headlines with Roger. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, just say, play WGN Radio, Mr. Badish. Hello, everybody. Matt Bubala with you, 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Showcase Studios here on the Magnificent Mile in the historic Tribune Tower, where it's finally getting relatively quiet out on Michigan Avenue, although some people are still out and about, Raj, and I want to say to them, it's 4 in the morning, people.
Yeah, the bar's just closed.
Well, most Chicago bars close at 2 a.m., I thought.
There are some 4 a.m.
There's some 4 a.m. bars. That's true. I think my friends at O'Callaghan's are a 4 a.m. bar, my favorite bar downtown.
I used to frequent back in my wild days. Mm-hmm. When I was going to college, and I'd work up here during my breaks. There was a 4 a.m. bar just off of Rush Street, kind of in a side street. Very small place, and it was great people. And used to hang out there till about 4 o'clock and then head home.
Those were good people.
Yeah.
4 a.m. is kind of a late time to be out, my friend.
Not when you're working at night. I think I got off at like midnight on my shifts. That's when I was working at the Playboy Hotel.
Yeah. I can understand why you'd want to be out at 4 a.m. then.
Doggy.
Okay. So we've been very busy tonight.
Yes. Marvelous.
Lots going
marvelous
on. We haven't chatted very much, you and I.
Yeah.
A couple of things I want to chat with you about.
Uh-oh. What did I do now?
No. You didn't do anything. Just interesting stories in the news. I mean, there's so much interesting stories.
There's so much.
First of all, you haven't even touched on Donald Trump.
Okay, you touched on him.
Well, it's funny. I made the joke at the beginning of the show about Macron.
I know.
Is it Macron?
Yeah.
Macron.
Yeah, well, you don't have to spit
You look so much. Very beautiful. You're in great physical shape. It'd be great if he did it in a Pepe Le Pew accent
and
as well, just to really annoy them.
Do you know the age difference between them?
Yes, because she was like his teacher, right?
Yes.
Scandalous. I'm very impressed with the French people for, you know, saying, although they're very, you know, very progressive in their sexual views compared to us.
But then look at our president and his wife. There's a big age difference there.
Yeah, but we generally overlook the older male, younger female demographic.
Yeah,
we tend to really stare at the younger male with an older female. That's the more unusual one.
Yeah.
She's a good 10 to 15 years older than him, right?
Mm-hmm. Something like that, yeah.
But in great physical shape. Look at you. Look at her.
Beautiful, he said.
Which is, you know, a compliment, but it's just so creepy. The way he does it is just so like, and sometimes, honest to God, Raj, I think he's doing that stuff on purpose, people. Because the cover of Time magazine this week, which is a really interesting cover, a really good
with
one.
With his son?
Donald Trump Jr. on the cover and a bunch of words kind of in the background and some of them in
more
bold, like lit
right.
up so you're going to be able to read them. And then the great headline is Caught Red-Handed.
Yeah. And those words, again, so people understand, it's not something someone made up. These
it's
are the actual
the emails,
words from
right?
his emails.
From the emails that he released.
Yeah. That he wrote.
He
answered.
It was his chain back and forth with the guy.
But some of them were his responses.
Yeah, his responses.
Yeah.
Sounds interesting. I'd love to see it, especially later in summer.
Yeah.
So it would be fascinating to see where all that goes. Yeah. But we don't have time for that, Roger. You know why?
Why?
Because of this headline that I saw earlier this week. For some reason, on businessinsider.com.
Oh.
Here's the headline.
Okay.
Chinese scientists just teleported an object into Earth's orbit for the first time.
Yeah, I saw that. Very interesting.
They're teleporting stuff.
Yeah.
Do you understand that?
Yep. Oh, yeah.
No. Do you really?
Yeah.
Because I don't.
What do you mean you don't
because
understand the science
like
behind it?
They took a TV remote and threw it out into space, Raj. It's not an episode of your show. Do you truly understand what in the hell
yes.
they're doing? How?
I don't want them to scramble my atoms. I'll tell you that.
See, I'm not ready for that. I don't think they're actually moving atoms in the way you're saying, though. I don't think this is like a...
I think they are.
All right, let's read a little bit from
this
and then figure out.
Go ahead.
So, not long ago, this is from businessinsider.com. Not long ago, in the early 1990s, scientists only speculated that teleportation using quantum physics could be possible. Since then, the process has become a standard operation in quantum optics labs around the world. In fact, just last year, two teams conducted the world's first quantum teleportation outside a laboratory. Now, researchers in China have taken the process a few steps further. They successfully teleported a photon from Earth to a satellite orbiting more than 311 miles away. The satellite, called Micius, is a highly sensitive photoreceiver capable of detecting the quantum states of single photons fired from the ground. Micius was launched to allow scientists to test various technological building blocks for quantum feats, including entanglement, cryptography, and teleportation. This teleportation feat was announced as one of the first results of these experiments. The group not only teleported the first object from the ground to orbit, but also created the first satellite-to-ground quantum network, smashing the record for the longest distance for which entanglement has been measured. Long-distance teleportation has been recognized as a fundamental element in protocols such as large-scale quantum networks and distributed quantum computation, the Chinese team told MIT Technology Review. Previous teleportation experiments between distant locations were limited to a distance on the order of 100 kilometers due to photon loss in optical fibers or terrestrial free space channels. Huh? Yeah. So, defining teleportation. What comes to mind when you think of teleportation? Your brain might conjure images of Scotty beaming up the Enterprise crew in Star Trek, but it's actually quite a different process than sci-fi films present. Quantum teleportation relies on quantum entanglement, a situation in which one set of quantum objects, such as photons, form at the same instant and point in space. In this way, they share the same existence. This shared existence continues even when the photons are separated, meaning a measurement on one immediately influences the state of the other, regardless of the distance between them. This link can be used to transmit quantum information by downloading the information associated with one photon over an entangled link to another photon. The second photon takes on the identity of the first. Voila, teleportation. I'm still giving it a...
Mm-hmm.
In this particular instance, the Chinese team created entangled pairs of photons on the ground at a rate of about 4,000 a second. It then beamed one of these photons to the satellite and kept the other photon on the ground. Finally, it measured the photons on the ground and in orbit to confirm that entanglement was taking place. It's worth noting that there are some limits to this technology. Transporting anything large, for instance, is a ways off. In theory, there's also no maximum transportation distance, but entanglement is fragile and the links can easily be broken. Despite these limits, this research paves the way for even more ambitious studies of quantum teleportation. This work establishes the first ground-to-satellite uplink for faithful and ultra-long-distance quantum teleportation, an essential step toward global-scale quantum internet, the team says.
I wouldn't get upset about it. I wouldn't get scared about it because we're just dealing with light and digital information, like ones and zeros.
Well, I'm not scared of it at all. You know. I'm just trying to figure out. So they create a pair of photons. They send one up in space to keep one here.
Right.
And it sounds to me like what they're saying is, if we mess with this photon that's here,
right,
the one over there is going to change in the same manner.
Exactly. Yeah.
So let's say I have this photon here on Earth.
Okay.
And I cut it in half.
You'll cut the one up there in half.
That's some crazy ass stuff. Yeah.
Because they're linked. From what I'm understanding.
That's awesome.
That's how they're able to do the teleportation, is there's a link with an existence here, and therefore you're able to match it somewhere else.
That's pretty cool. So, yeah. But that really is not teleportation as we think of it from Star Trek.
No.
Because it's not like they can take me and put me there.
But it is.
If they made two of me at once and they shot one of me up there, they could punch me in the face, and up there I'd go, wow, that hurts.
Exactly.
So I wonder if there's a sort of teleportation – between twins or triplets or things like that, because you hear the stories before of, you know, somebody that has a side pain in Philadelphia and their twin in California is getting an appendicitis.
Right. I don't think that's the same.
Maybe it is. Well, maybe there's something to that.
Yeah, but I don't think it's a teleportation of matter, which is what they're talking about.
So when they're doing something to the photon here and it's affecting the photon up there, it's because there is some sort of link that sends that message up to the other one?
There is a material link, yes. I think the twins, the identical twins thing, is more of a biological situation. And again, we don't have any scientific data on that.
But they
we
have
just
to be
have
connected
anecdotal
somehow, right?
data, huh?
But, I mean, if that happened between twins, I mean, I don't know.
That's just anecdotal. No one studied that. We don't understand it at all. This we do. Quantum physics that, well, you.
Somebody does. It ain't you and I.
You know how we understand it? Like this. That's it. But I have an understanding, cursory understanding of it, that it that just makes sense without having the scientific data with me or being that smart.
It still doesn't make sense to me.
Okay.
I mean, it's crazy cool.
You understand the concept, though, right?
Not exactly. I mean, basically, you're creating something that's two of the same thing, and you're sending one away, and somehow they're still connected,
because
even though there's no wires between them or anything
right,
else.
But
sort of like they got this Wi-Fi, Bluetooth connection going. But if I split one here on Earth,
right.
You're telling me that one up in space will split in half.
That's my understanding of what you just read. Yes.
That's some crazy nonsense right there.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, we can't get people to believe in climate change. How are we going to get them to go along with this, Roger?
Well, now you're in a whole new subject area.
I mean, I want to see it. I want to see some. It's cool that they've done it and they're telling us.
Mm-hmm.
But if you really want me on board, then you got to cut a photon in half and show me how up in space that thing splits in half.
Yeah.
It's like David Blaine craziness, like to a tenth degree. You know what I mean?
To like a millionth degree.
Something like that.
Yeah.
I really want to see that.
I'd love to see what they're doing. Just out of curiosity, because I love science.
I love science, too. I just don't understand it.
Mm.
Which makes it tougher.
I would have loved to have been an astronaut.
There's still time.
Nah, not in my health. I pass
that's
out.
What that's what you pitch him on. Well, who went up, Senator Glenn?
Yeah.
Got to go back
but
in
he'd been
space.
Up once before. He was used to it. He knew what was going on.
Right. But.
Me, they'd put me in that G gravity, thing that spins around, and I'd be like a flat mess when they'd stop it.
Now let's see how you do it in space.
Just a couple of eyes staring at him with a real big grin on my face going, "Wee, that was fun."
Would you have a grin or would you have throw up all over your shirt? Because I would have throw up
I would
all
have
over
both.
My shirt.
I would have both. They would hear this. If there was a microphone inside, they would hear me screaming for happy every time I'd be going around.
I would literally have absolutely zero grin. No grin at all. There'd be zero grin and throw up everywhere, and it would be a lot of unhappiness.
Oh, you got to have fun with something like that. Seriously. Remember you were talking about the, weren't we talking about it last week, about the things you really, really wanted, your bucket list and stuff?
Yes. Yeah, you had the most boring things in the world.
I know.
Can we put astronaut on it?
Yeah, put astronaut
okay,
on
see, now that's
yeah,
better. Now you're
yeah,
doing better.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, good.
I would love to do something like that. Even though since I've been about, I think maybe when I turned like 25 or 26, I suddenly got this inner ear weirdness.
Oh, I have that.
You understand what I'm talking about?
I can't even swing on a swing, Raj.
Yeah, I know.
When I swing high on a swing, my stomach hurts.
Yeah.
That feels like the most stupid feeling ever.
So here's the thing. Riverview, one of my favorite ride there was the centrifugal force
that
wheel
terrible.
Where the bottom drops out.
Mm-hmm.
You're like flatten against the side.
They still do that at all the carnivals.
Yeah, right. There's similar things. Yeah. And I loved it because they used to have pictures, photos of things people would do. Like there would be two guys sitting at a table playing cards. And
while they were doing it?
Right. While the thing was spinning and the bottom would drop out and they'd still be sitting there. The table would be flattened, the table and chairs flattened against the side, and they'd be sitting playing cards. It was the most wild thing. I love that. And I used to do it all the time, and I would, like, lift my legs up and try to cross them and cross my arms and turn sideways and everything when this thing was spinning. It was my favorite ride. It was, like, the only ride I would go to at Riverview. Then I think I turned about 25 or 26, and I, you know, our daughter had just been born, and I wanted to take her out on Ferris wheels and the roller coasters and stuff. And literally, I took her a couple of years later on a roller coaster, and it wasn't like a wild, you know, one, not like one of the top 10 or whatever.
Right.
This was like a kid's kind of thing. I didn't even get a quarter of the way through. I was ready to chuck it up. Seriously, I've lost all equilibrium for something like that. And I love that kind of stuff.
That stinks, too, because you really love it and you want to do it. Like, I hate it, and I don't want to do it, so it doesn't bother me.
Yeah,
I'm happy not to have it, quite honestly. I got to ask you a sports question real quick.
Okay.
Because this came up last week. You were reporting, I think you were reporting, on Wimbledon. And Venus is in the finals, or did she win the whole thing?
She's on the finals. She's 37. The finals are today.
She's 37?
37.
Oh, wait. Venus is.
Oh, wait. Are we talking about...
is it the older sister or the younger sister? Venus is the older sister.
Hold on a second.
Serena is fully pregnant or had a baby?
Yeah. No, I think she's still pregnant.
Okay.
Yeah, I think she's still pregnant.
She actually just, my Vanity Fair just showed up at home, and she's on the cover in the old Demi Moore pose.
Yeah, with the nothing on but your hand.
Although, actually, she has underwear on, which Demi did not.
Well, that's true.
So, either way, you still see her.
Yeah, she is, Venus is 37.
All right, and she's the one, Venus is in the finals.
Right.
Serena is probably taking this Wimbledon off, is my guess.
Yeah, one would think.
She's with child. Yeah. So, John McEnroe was being interviewed by somebody a week or so ago, I think, who kind of made a big deal about Serena and all the Grand Slams she's won. I don't know if she's going for a fourth one here or what she's
fifth.
Doing.
Well, she's won five.
Okay.
I think this would be her sixth.
So, I thought there was something in about Serena and how good she is, this or that. And McEnroe didn't, if I remember correctly, he didn't seem to exactly comment. And the person asking the question said something to him, and he said, well, are we talking about just women or all tennis players?
Right.
Because if we're talking about all, she'd be ranked like 400th right now.
Right. I remember that. That was from last weekend.
And I don't know if the interviewer got offended at that or not, or if it wasn't until it got passed around.
Mm-hmm.
But McEnroe basically rigged her and said, yeah, she wouldn't even, you know, she'd be like 200 if men were included.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of that? Do you think that is just a fact that, listen, men are bigger and stronger, and you see how hard they serve, and it's 120 versus just 100 or whatever the difference is? And
I'd be naive if I took my altruistic approach to this kind of stuff, because that would mean that I would be ignoring the fact that people in general do classify men and women separately in sports, or else you would see men and women playing baseball together, football together. You wouldn't see separate teams. You wouldn't see you would see a men's a Wimbledon final with the two best players total in the world. You wouldn't see a women's final and a men's final. So I would be naive to think that the world is perfect and men and women are equal in all things. I think that, and I heard a discussion on this too. Actually, I think it was on The Beat last week on Sunday.
Okay.
That what you just said is true from a strength standpoint, at least. They broke it down, the speed of the serves, and that kind of stuff. That if you took the ranking of men in the world for tennis, at least, that her numbers would not come in until like the 100th place or something like that.
Wow. That's
so they took it from like a scientific approach.
And so should women be offended by that, or just like, hey, yeah, we understand we get to have babies. Sometimes you're going to be better athletes than us. That's the trade-off.
Well, I think possibly women became offended at how he put it, or their perception of how he put it. I think that it was taken as a put down, and he even came back later, from what I remember reading, to clarify that was not, he did not mean it as a put down. That just in general, from a competitive standpoint, based on the records and the scientific numbers from tennis, that's where she would fit in. So it's like if you would take a woman's baseball team, let's say one of the teams during World War II, okay, if you would take their statistics, those players' statistics, and match them up to a men's team statistics, where would they fall?
That is the million-dollar question, which we're not going to know the answer to. But I remember when who was our shortstop that came from the Red Sox, and when Omar came,
oh,
and then Mia Hamm followed him, and she was, I think, on John's show, and John said something to her, you know, all these people are getting shows. Wouldn't you like to? Rah, rah, rah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. 312-981-7200. Let's take a break. We're going to talk about the running of the Bulls next. 720 WGN. Matt Bubala with you. 720 WGN. Max and O coming up with the morning show in 25 minutes here on 720 WGN. Last weekend, we checked in to Pamplona, Spain with Mark Schipper, who I used to work with over at DNAinfo.com here in Chicago. Mark is now working on a documentary, and as part of that, they've been out at the festival in Pamplona, and he's filming and watching and seeing the running of the Bulls. The news headline today says the final bull run of the 2017 San Fermin Festival in Pamplona left 13 people injured Friday, the highest number this year, but no gorings despite being the fastest dash of all eight held in the northern Spanish city. Medical officials said a 30-year-old visitor from the United States was the most seriously injured in Friday's eighth and last run. I'm going to guess that Mark is about 30 years old. We were debating whether he was going to do it or not. Let's find out if Mark ever ran with the Bulls. Hey, Mark Schipper, good morning. How are you, bud?
I'm good. How are you doing? I'm glad both of us managed to survive this week.
Well, it was easier for me over here because I don't have Bulls around me every morning, I do have the desire to run with the Bulls someday. I don't know if I'd actually do it if I watched it all week long. Did you ever end up running with the Bulls?
This is the big reveal right here.
Okay, here we go.
I did not run with the Bulls.
Oh, Mark, what are you doing?
Man. Wimp, wimp, wimp.
What happened?
Wimp.
Yeah, well, you know, there are a lot of reasons, good reasons, and they'll sound like excuses over the phone from this distance, but it just it didn't work. I was working the mornings. I was doing man on the street bits right after the runs, interviewing foreign runners. Most of the time at that hour before that, I wasn't in a great state to be running anyway. And, you know, my first time through, I was happy to be watching it. I watched very closely. I picked up a lot of details, especially from the native runners. And this definitely won't be my last San Fermin, so maybe I'll come back next year and I'll get down on the course with them.
Was it all work-related and too much drinking the night before? Was any of it, I've videotaped this all week long, and I could see, you know, I see a lot of bad things happen, and I just don't want that to be me right now?
Yeah, that was part of it. It was work-related. I watched the video, actually was helpful. It was like watching game film. I was lucky enough to get kind of connected with some of the Basque runners out here, and one of them, who a lot of people consider the greatest runner going right now, a local kid named Aitor, who actually was the closest on that last run that you just talked about to getting gored. They have a great word for it out here when the Bulls trample people. They call them traumatismos, like inflicting trauma.
Yeah.
And a lot of people got run over, and he runs in the last section of the course. It's called Telefonica, into the tunnel and then into the arena, and he runs right on the Bulls' horns every day. He's like he's a professional with his consistency. And he and a very experienced runner got pinched up against the wall in the tunnel. And these are big Mira Bowls, very famous. Lamborghini has named cars after these Mira Bowls, including the Mira itself. And they're big, they're fast. They got pinched up against the side of a tunnel, and actually his mentor actually grabbed a bull's horn as it was pushing into Aitor's back and sort of redirected the horn. And then Aitor was trampled by the bull and sort of got knocked under the tunnel wall. And it ended up being, I don't know, he went to the hospital for a while. He might have some kind of knee injury, but he's going to be okay. But he was actually the closest to being gored, and he's probably the best runner on the course.
When you say that he's one of the best runners, he's considered this or that, is there any benefit to him in any of that? Are these guys, like, sponsored? Do they get money? Or is it just, I'm famous because I run in the bull thing?
It's very much a traditional honor and a pecking order. They're extremely humble people about it. They just, it's just part of their life. It's hard to put into context for Americans, because running with the Bulls seems like such an insane thing to do. It's part of their culture. They grew up doing it. He grew up watching these guys ahead of him, and it was just something he wanted to be a part of. And then it turns out he's a great athlete. He actually, I was telling somebody, one of his runs, he looked like old Gale Sayers highlight videos. People fall in front of him. He hurdles them. He kind of actually stiff arms the Bulls' snouts at certain times, so he can stiff arm their snout, know where they are behind him, and look in front of him to clear any traffic that goes down in front of him so he doesn't get tripped up. And he's just an amazing runner.
That's so fascinating. What else did you film this week that you were stunned by or surprised by?
You know, the pageantry of the entire feria is what's amazing. So I was kind of in awe of everything. They have these eight giants, they're called gigantes, and they represent different parts of the earth, and they're like, I don't know, 12 feet high. They parade through the streets. People follow in their procession. They mess around with little kids. It's funny, a lot of this stuff, they're like really old costumes and really weird, like grotesque heads and stuff like that. And a lot of it seems to be out there to frighten young children. People are out there with kids in their strollers and four-year-olds walking by, and these big giants will, like, turn around and say, you know, give, like, a boo sort of thing to the kids, and the kids will scream and run away and come back. So one of the things that amazed me most is when you're not running with the bulls or watching the corrido, which is the bullfight, in the afternoon, the rest of the festival is really a family affair. It's families, husbands, wives, children, and the harmony of the whole thing. So the whole thing had me in awe. As a first time through, you got to come back again because you miss too much. There's too much to see.
Yeah, it sounds like it. It sounds like it, that it really is. How much of the festival, you say it's really a family affair, but at night, does it become more of an adult affair? I mean, there is a lot of drinking and carousing type going on.
Yeah, definitely. It definitely becomes more adult after dark. But really, that starts after 11 p.m. 11 p.m. every night, they put on the greatest fireworks show you've ever seen.
Really?
And everybody goes to the park and different places. Yeah, it's actually a competition. I'm not sure how many countries they come from or if they're all the Spain's best. But each night, they try to outdo the show from the night before. A new firework crew comes in. They set up their show. And it's like 15-plus minutes of fireworks and then grand finales that just leave but your eyes flashing and your ears ringing. And I posted some video of it on my Instagram, and I'll post a little bit more. They're just mind-blowing fireworks. So it's like a great way. The families all go there, watch the fireworks, and then they walk them home in their strollers. And the adults head back to the old town and get into that sangria.
Wow. It sounds like a really, really interesting trip. What did you fall in love with as far as the city and the people outside of the Bull Run? What do we need to know about the San Fermín Festival and Pamplona itself?
The Spanish are some of the most hospitable people on earth. They are so kind to foreigners and people at their festival, helpful. Up here in the north, fewer people speak English than the rest of Spain. So a lot lot of times you'll run into a little bit of communication barrier if you don't speak Spanish, and nobody in America speaks Basque. So if they only speak Basque, you're in a little bit of trouble. But there's a tremendous effort made to communicate and assist and show and help and share food and share drinks and enjoy each other's company. It's nothing like Wrigleyville after a Cubs game. It's not riotous. It's kind and friendly and really enjoying each other's company. And it's a lot of fun.
I love the festival because of Hemingway's book, The Sun Also Rises, which I've read a bunch of times. And in it, they get this big, cask maybe of wine, something like a big leather satchel full of wine that they'll carry around.
Yeah, the Boda bags.
Are people doing that there? Is there a lot of that?
Yeah, there's quite a bit of that. It's not as much as it was in his time, I don't think. That was that's a very old, rustic way of carrying around your wine. They'd take those bags out to the field with them. And so it was almost like practical usage in the city in those days. Like, I remember that scene in The Sun Also Rises when they go in to buy their bag and the guy blows up the bag and puts the cap on to show them that it didn't have any leaks.
Yeah.
There was like a craftsmanship to it. And people would walk around the streets with those spraying wine into each other's mouth. And there is still quite a bit of that goes on, but like everywhere else in the world, it's a lot of plastic cups these days and drinking the modern way. But those are still around. And actually, at the I went to the final corrido, which is the bullfight of the festival, last night, and a matador had a good show. And somebody in the crowd, when you have a real good show, they'll give you a tour around the ring, and everybody throws down cigars and hats and all this stuff. And somebody threw down a Boda bag, and the matador took the greatest, longest, highest pour I think I've ever seen. And it must have been 20 seconds of a straight shot of wine into his mouth, doing like a 360 with a big flourish at the end. And he threw the bag back up. And it was amazing.
When can we expect to see some of this documentary, Mark?
So the documentary, I believe they want to have a sort of basically finished product on the website in March of 2017 or 2018, pardon me. So March 2018, but the Instagram feeds, the Facebook page, all of this stuff is being updated with snippets, clips, previews. So you can go to those pages. It's a Fiesta Pamplona, and check some of that stuff out and start getting excited about what we're going to see. You know, we got a bunch of interviews to transcribe and videos to edit and all that stuff, but we're working hard on it.
Can I ask a quick question?
Of course.
Saw a report this is Roger in the newsroom. I still say you wimped out. But I saw a report a couple of days ago that one of the injuries was to a gentleman in the Nether regions. Did you hear of that also?
Yeah, are you talking about, I think this is appropriate for a butt cheek?
No, I heard it was in another front part of the area.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You know, there may have been something there, but if that was a big injury, that did not make the round. So that may have been exaggerated somewhere. That would have been a big story out here because those are rare and very bad.
Yeah, you basically kind of have to be running backwards for something like that to happen.
Or running towards the bulls.
Right. running in the wrong direction.
You know, I don't know. The bulls' horns are all different. Some of them hook down, some hook up, some hook left and right. So, you know, if you get underneath at the right angle and swing up, I don't know, you might be able to hit a certain spot.
Youch.
Mark Shipper, you can follow on Twitter at MyTimesPros, right? At MyTimesPros?
Yes, sir.
At My Times Pros. And what's the website if they want to find out more about the documentary right now?
It is FiestaPamplona.com. And that's just FIESTA Pamplona, the city's name, .com.
FiestaPamplona.com. We'll watch for more coming up soon as they get back home and get it all together. And hopefully next year we'll chat with Mark as he finally makes his first run with the Bulls.
Yes, sir. Let's make that happen.
All right, Mark. Thanks so much for checking in. Have a safe trip home. We'll talk to you soon.
All right, guys. I appreciate it. Take care.
Thanks, buddy. Thanks for jumping on the phone. Mark Shipper at My Times Pros on Twitter. Very fascinating. Very fascinating.
Yeah.
I still would love to do it.
Well, then go with him next year. next time.
All right. Well, you talk to Colleen. Tell her I gotta go.
Well, just say you got a. You've got a convention or something. It happens to be in Spain.
Well, maybe I have to go help work on this documentary.
Yeah.
They need some help.
Right. You're a big-time video producer.
Big time.
I know.
Big time. Bigly.
Bigly.
Through in 2981-7200. Speaking of bucket lists, there's something really cool I've always wanted to do that I've seen video of. But it turns out it could kill you.
Well, then don't
so
do it.
I'll tell you what that is next. 720 WGN. Mac Bubala with you, 720 WGN, for a few more minutes here. Orion is along with the morning show at the top of the hour. So I was telling Raj that, you know, we talk about our bucket list and the things we want to do and get done before we die. One thing I've always seen video of on the internet is it called St. Martin's? It's M-A-A-R-T-E-N-S.
Yeah, I think that's what it's pronounced.
So there's a different St. Martin's, right? I've never seen St. Martin's before, M-A-A-R-T-N-S. T-E-N-S. It is in the Caribbean. It's a Caribbean island.
I think my folks went there a long time ago. They did the Caribbean tour on a cruise. Yeah.
So there they have a Princess Juliana Airport, which is just a few steps away from the beach. There's a road. There's a tiny little strip of beach next to what looks like just gorgeous, beautiful waters.
Mm-hmm. A very crowded beach, too.
Yes. And then a very small roadway, and then a fence. And right next to the fence is the airport and a big runway. So there's really cool things where you stand there and watch these planes literally fly what looks like about 5 to 10 feet over your head.
Yeah.
Like really dropping down because 2 feet later they've crossed and now they're landing.
Yeah.
So people take awesome video of that and see that all the time. Watch it. What they also seem to do is stand against the fence, jets will take off from right there.
Mm-hmm.
So the jets come down the runway and turn right there and then are ready to take off. And so what they do is they rev their engines, and that jet blast as they take off is very powerful and sends people flying. So people stand on the beach and then go rolling into the water. And it looks like sometimes people hold onto the fence. So there's video that TMZ has, and it's a very sad story, of a woman who was holding the fence. I mean, there's signs that warn you not to do this.
Big
things
signs.
Like that.
Yeah.
She's holding onto the fence as a jet is going to take off. And the jet starts taking off, and it starts blowing all this energy. And you see stuff in the air. You see the wind flying. And you see her holding on with a grip on the fence. I see a guy go tumbling down the beach all the way into the water. And when she can't hold on anymore and she lets go, that thing shoots her.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is, right there at the beach, there's a concrete barrier, too.
Yeah.
A smaller one. She went flying headfirst right into it,
and
she died.
I don't understand some people.
I totally would have been there doing it.
No,
now, I don't
you
think
wouldn't.
I would have stood and held the fence. I would have been down on the beach to just laugh and enjoy and get blown over, maybe.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't have stood right
Don't
there on the
stand
fence.
Behind a plane that has its jet engines blasting. Come on.
Is that a no-no?
That's a huge no-no.
All right, we've got, oh.
First of all, you got a nice head of hair, right?
Well, I still have hair. I don't know
you still
nice
have hair. Hair. Well, you wouldn't.
All right, we've got one more little tidbit I want to share, and then we're going to check in with Orion with the morning show next on 720 WGN. I wanted to pass along a note to my alma mater, St. Mary's University, up in Winona, Minnesota, with St. Mary's College back when I went there, but now we're fancy and we're a university. And sadly, there was a passing of an instructor who was there for many years. Father Andrew Fabian was 90 years old. He taught at St. Mary's for 50 years. Taught philosophy. I never had him, but all my friends and my wife had him for class when he was there. He retired in 2013, but was still a scholar in residence, was still guiding students and encouraging students up until shortly before his passing. He was known for his memory. He had a photographic memory. And on the first day of class, every year, he would freak the kids out, Raj, by calling out. He would stand at the front of the class, no paper, no pen, nothing in hand,
right,
and would call out roll call. He had memorized every class's list.
Amazing.
That he taught. So 5-6 classes a day, maybe sometimes. He would know everybody's name and call them out, call out roll call.
You know, it took me over half a year, a school year, before I could match a face with names in my classes. Seriously, I was really bad at it. I mean, I knew some of the main ones, but then the other ones who, like, hardly ever showed up. I who are you? Oh, okay.
He knew them the day they walked in. His mantra was good, better, best. Never let it rest until the good becomes better and the better becomes best.
That's awesome.
Good segue. Speaking of the best, to our friend Orion Samuelson, who I believe is live from WGN West this morning. Good morning, Big O.